Welcome to The Forest and the Trees, Global and Local Perspectives on the Environment, with your host, Melinda Tuhus. Well, the news has been traveling faster than we can keep up with. And last week, I think it was July 6th, I interviewed Lauren Stockman, who's a senior analyst with Oil Change International, a nonprofit based in D.C. that does a lot of fossil fuel research. So we talked that morning, and a few hours later, there was a major decision from the Supreme Court that we'll talk about briefly at the end. The first thing we talked about was the bombshell announcement on July 5th that Duke and Dominion, energy behemoths in North Carolina and Virginia, respectively, were dropping their six-year effort to build the Atlantic Coast frack gas pipeline through West Virginia, Virginia, and North Carolina. He starts by talking about the pipeline fighters.
They've just lived and breathed this that entire time, you know, responding and commenting on every single permit and contributing to legal cases. And I know so many of them have had many sleepless nights and have just, worried over this and, given their everything to stop this pipeline for the last 6 years. So I'm sure for those people, this just comes as the most tremendous relief and a day that for a long time they were never sure. I think they always held out hope, but were just never sure they would ever see this day so definitively. You know, I think we've seen pipeline victories before where permits have been denied and, in many cases, the companies have pushed ahead and in some cases have been defeated, but in others, not so much. And this is something quite different where the two huge corporations that have been pushing this thing down people's throats for the last 6 years have themselves announced that they are not going to pursue it further. And so, you know, this is a tremendous and definitive victory against the pipeline. I think in terms of its... In terms of what this means nationally and for other pipeline fights around the country and just kind of the bigger picture, I think it's also huge because what's happened here is, you know, it's another case where it's become clear that federal government agencies, whether it's the Army Corps of Engineers, the Forest Service in the case of ACP, Fish and Wildlife, and numerous other federal and state level agencies, issued permits illegally and erroneously. And that's what we've just seen with the Dakota Access Pipeline, that the courts have found the Army Corps did not do what it was mandated to do under the National Environmental Protection Act, and so vacated the permit. With ACP, there were so many permits that were erroneously issued and vacated in the courts that it just became insurmountable for the companies to continue. I think this shows it's clear that the corporate capture of the regulatory bodies in this country has been very wide indeed. When the opposition has the resources to actually take this to court and fight it, we win because these permits have been wrongly issued. And one shudders to think how many pipelines have been built in the last decade as a result of this fracking boom that were built with permits that should never have been issued, and there just wasn't the legal resources to fight it.
I'd like to add another regulatory agency that's been captured by industry, and that's FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the body that's issued more than 400 permits for gas infrastructure over the years, including pipelines, compressor stations, liquefied natural gas terminals, and storage facilities, and denied only two.
Right. So I think, the ACP victory in particular shows you know, exposes not only this capture of the regulatory system and how flawed it is and how one-sided it has been, but the other piece also is that the the rise of renewable energy, clean energy, wind, solar, storage, you know, has now reached the point where the market demand for gas is shrinking. The writing is on the wall. The companies are seeing that, so they're weighing these options of, you know, spending more money to push this through the courts against a diminishing economic case that has just shrunk over the period in which they've been pushing the project, trying to push the project through.
I was actually on a walk a few years ago to raise awareness in coastal North Carolina against the pipeline. You know, originally the pipeline route was planned to go through the Piedmont around Raleigh, and it was moved to the Eastern Seaboard, which is the poorest part of the state with the highest population of people of color and indigenous people. And right after the ACP was canceled, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, leader of the Poor People's Campaign and a North Carolina native, and Al Gore issued a joint statement saying that in order to succeed in any of these struggles, it's necessary to be intersectional in our strategy. In other words, to fight for environmental, climate, and racial justice simultaneously. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, these projects, you know, disproportionately impact communities of color, indigenous communities, low-income communities. There's a real systemic foundation to that. You rarely see these projects, routes, you know, going through wealthy middle-class suburban areas or other, you know, wealthy landowners. ACP has been remarkable in the movement that's built up around it was very broad-based. And you know, yeah. I mean, you can't oppose these projects without, you know, building this broad base of opposition across community divides, across class divides, across racial divides. You know, there's this kind of the nature of the beast in terms of, you know, those are the communities that are impacted. ACP was interesting, you know, because it cut through those communities. It did actually cut through some wealthy or, you know, relatively wealthy farms in Augusta County, Virginia, and other areas. It cut through national forest lands. It kind of connected all sorts of issues in so many ways. It was such a poorly conceived project. The idea of pushing this 42-inch pipeline across some of the steepest terrain, ridge after ridge, mountain after mountain across eastern West Virginia and western Virginia, and then, you know, through these poor rural communities in the plains of Virginia and on into North Carolina through some of the poorest parts of the state. So, you know, it was a huge project, 600 miles. And, the opposition against it was near universal. I think organizers realized early on that the way forward was to reach across all these communities and bring them together.
I'm speaking with Lauren Stockman, senior researcher with Oil Change International. I read the company's press release. It sounds like they're throwing in the towel on the ACP, but Dominion is selling most of its gas investments to Berkshire Hathaway. That's Warren Buffett, called the Oracle of Omaha for his business acumen, right?
Warren Buffett, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I think I saw an article in the Financial Times last week questioning whether Warren Buffett lost his edge because he's made some very risky and productive investments recently, particularly in the oil and gas shale industry in the United States. He was pivotal in the buyout of huge shale company Anadarko by Occidental Petroleum, and that has not gone well at all. So, it remains to be seen. Warren Buffett is an interesting character who has, he's made a lot of money, but he's also lost a lot of money on some bad bets over the years. So I think this one remains to be seen. I think it's very interesting that Dominion, not only pulled back from the pipeline, but has sold these gas assets across the board, all except the LNG export plant in Maryland, of course. But has really, divested a significant proportion of its gas interests, and hopefully that's signaling some real change. I mean, there's still a lot that remains to be seen with Dominion on, how much it's really investing in clean energy for Virginia and elsewhere. I think that's something still to watch, but it's certainly, a very interesting addition to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline announcement that they're getting out of what was a significant portion of their business in the gas distribution network that they owned in West Virginia and elsewhere.
I also did some work starting 6 years ago with Beyond Extreme Energy, supporting a coastal community in southern Maryland that was fighting a huge liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export terminal at Cove Point. This was, incredibly, right in the middle of a residential neighborhood, and residents were terrified that if there were an explosion, they wouldn't be able to get out. My understanding is that Dominion is keeping part ownership of that facility.
I think they're keeping a controlling interest in Cove Point, but I think that Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett's organization, is getting a piece of that, but they're not getting, a controlling interest. Dominion is keeping hold of that.
But except for Cove Point, Dominion is selling all its gas business to Berkshire Hathaway?
Well, that's what I understand from the press release, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They own this big gap, they owned a lot of what they call gathering pipelines where, in the fracked gas fields in West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania, and the gas, that network kind of brings gas from the gas wells to central hubs and processing plants. I think they owned a processing business which, processes the gas for onward sale. They own a gas pipeline network in the west of the country as well that they bought. They bought a company a few years ago that owned gas pipelines, I believe, in, you might need to check this, but Colorado and, west of the Rockies region. I believe they're selling out of that. And that's significant. That's significant for Dominion because Dominion has been a cheerleader for gas. It's been up until very recently was highly committed to its gas business, at least in public statements. They've changed their tune on gas a lot. And part of that is, the clean energy legislation that was passed in Virginia, which basically, sets targets for phasing out gas in Virginia. And that's really been the writing on the wall for Dominion. It's changed the playing field for them. And, these are huge changes that have taken place in Virginia in recent years, partly as a result of the opposition to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Dominion ruled the roost and wrote energy legislation in Richmond, Virginia for years and years and years. It's the most powerful corporation in the state, and it usually gets everything it wants. And as a result of just the sheer arrogance of this project and there's almost universal opposition to it across the state of Virginia, you know, its social license has kind of been chipped away in the state over the last few years, and more legislators have stood up to it in writing legislation in Virginia. And that came to a head when Democrats took the General Assembly last year. Many of those newly elected Democrats got in on a ticket of opposing Dominion and refusing to take their money in campaign finance donations. So, you know, this has changed the landscape in Virginia and changed Dominion's decision-making calculus on the future of its gas assets and its gas business. You know, and for Duke, I think Duke, in, which has a similar position in North Carolina as being, you know, the most the big regulated monopoly utility and one that writes the rules for its business in the state legislature. I think Duke is also seeing the writing on the wall that things are changing, and that this project in particular has cost them a lot of social license among citizens of the states that they operate in.
You're listening to my conversation with Lauren Stockman, who's a researcher with Oil Change International. Is 42-inch diameter the biggest size of the pipelines in operation and or proposed? That's the average size of a five-year-old child.
It's one of the biggest diameters that you're going to see. You do see some, you know, down in Texas, you will see some shorter distance pipelines that are kind of bringing gas from regional hubs to particular projects. You know, you might occasionally see bigger, but 42-inch is a very big diameter for a pipeline. It's never been done across these mountains, the Allegheny Mountains. You know, there are a couple of pipelines in this area. They're generally a much smaller diameter, more like 20 inches. But the audacity of this project, where it envisioned crossing mountain after mountain after mountain, from one side of the Alleghenies to the other, with such a large diameter pipeline, it was just unprecedented. And the citizens in these mountain counties were just not having it.
Totally coincidentally, the morning of the afternoon the decision was announced, I called a friend of mine in West Virginia. I hadn't talked to her in about a year. She lives in Charleston, but she grew up in Pocahontas County, which has a lot of the highest elevation mountains in the state. They haven't been leveled by mountaintop removal mining because there's no coal there. And she said it's the source of eight rivers, and the ACP was planned to go right through there.
Birthplace of seven or eight rivers, yes. Yes, I've been, Pocahontas County is just west of here. I've been up there. It's a remarkable place. It's, and it's really the stupidest place to put a pipeline. It just, like, doesn't make any sense at all. Nobody really wants it there. It's going to cause huge amounts of damage. It's going to be unstable. It's going to be dangerous.
You think there's no chance, then, that the ACP could be resurrected?
I mean, never say never, right? But it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not clear that Berkshire Hathaway has bought any interest in ACP. I don't know. I mean, we don't know for sure. But, you know, the pipeline does not have any permits. Its markets are turning away from gas to renewable energy at an ever faster rate. It faces opposition in every county along its route. I can't see the economic case for Berkshire Hathaway to try and push it forward. I believe they would have to, you know, those FERC permits are expiring. They'd have to go through all of this all over again. I doubt very much that that's on the cards at this point.
I'm speaking with Lauren Stockman, senior researcher with Oil Change International. What about the Mountain Valley Pipeline, MVP? It also goes through West Virginia, Virginia, and into North Carolina, along a route similar to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
Yeah, no, MVP's gotten further along. It's a slightly different route, actually. It goes, a much larger part of the route goes through West West Virginia, and it comes into Virginia further south. You know, but yes, it crosses the Appalachian Trail, it crosses the Blue Ridge Mountains, it crosses the Alleghenies. What's happened with it is that they've mostly put pipe in the ground along the route, except for where it crosses creeks and rivers. They have their permits to, and again, this comes down to the Army Corps of Engineers erroneously issuing permits that should never have been issued. So the pipeline has been sort of half built, all but the river crossings, of which there are hundreds and hundreds. So it's further along, but in terms of them being able to complete the project, they have to get this Army Corps permit issued, and that's looking very shaky right now. The Army Corps is now under intense scrutiny for issuing permits that it should never have issued in the first place, over and over again. That's the issue with the Dakota Access. That's the issue with Keystone XL. That was one of the, apparently insurmountable issues with Atlantic Coast. So, I think the case for MVP also following in the footsteps of ACP is very strong. So we're watching out for that in the coming days and weeks, and trying to support the organizers and the landowners and the folks fighting that down in the southern part of the state. And fingers crossed that it will follow in the footsteps of ACP.
U.S. District Court Judge Brian Morris in Montana ruled in April that TC Energy, previously and infamously known as TransCanada, could not proceed with construction of the Keystone XL pipeline because of violations of the Endangered Species Act. And then he paused all pipeline construction across rivers and streams, right?
That's right. It's this thing called the Nationwide Permit 12, which the Army Corps has been erroneously using for dozens of projects, in order to kind of avoid having to examine the environmental impact of every river crossing and of these routes, which it should be doing. So, instead of doing the job properly, they kind of had this backdoor way of just permitting the route and leaving the onus of environmental protection to the company itself to implement best practice to cross all of these streams. And the judge in Montana just said, that's a joke. That's flying in the face of what the Army Corps is supposed to be doing under the National Environmental Protection Act. And so when he did that for Keystone XL, he also threw into question Army Corps' issuing of nationwide Permit 12 across the board. And that's, surprise, surprise, that's how Mountain Valley Pipeline got permitted, and that's how ACP got permitted, and that's how, unfortunately, dozens and dozens of pipelines that have been built in the past decade got permitted. And so, it has thrown into question every single project that hasn't actually put pipe in the, isn't actually operating yet, and it's vacated those permits. And that's where MVP stands right now.
What do they have to do to be able to finish these other projects?
My understanding is that Army Corps now has to go back and review all those crossings and decide whether they are acceptable in terms of, or what the company has to do to protect those water bodies as they go through. And that's an enormous job because, I don't know how much time you spend in these mountains here, but there are water crossings every couple of, sometimes several per mile, right? I mean, these creeks just wind and bend and, you try and draw a straight line for a pipeline route across these mountains, and you're just going to cross water bodies every few hundred yards. So my understanding is, you know, Army Corps has this huge task to comply with the law if it's going to permit these projects. And that really throws into question whether these projects can be built in compliance with the law, which is, you know, why these legal teams have gone to court and successfully vacated these permits.
One thing that's really outrageous is that even if and when some of these pipeline projects are stopped, the companies have done tremendous damage already, cutting down untold numbers of trees, digging trenches, increasing the likelihood of flooding, disrupting species habitat.
That's right. I mean, this is a huge, you know, in many ways, this is a huge scandal in so many ways because, you know, hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of landowners have been abused by this process which the law is supposed to protect them from. And Army Corps of Engineers has just, you know, allowed this to happen. And, you know, just because ACP has been cancelled now, or even, and if MVP is also cancelled further down the line, it's not over for these landowners because they've already been taken to court and had land taken away by eminent domain. And to get that land back and to be made right, they'll be fighting in court for years to come. So, you know, this whole process has burdened these landowners and these communities with just years and years of worry and anxiety and costs and, you know, and spending, you know, hours and hours of their days, you know, writing these comments and fulfilling what needs to be done to take these companies to court. You know, in the Constitution Pipeline case, where I don't know if you're familiar, I think it was the Hollerans.
I was there. That fight was several years ago on the farm where this family in Pennsylvania was trying to save its maple trees that it tapped for sap from being cut down because they were in the path of the pipeline.
Right. So they have only just won back their land, right? That just happened this week, right? That is now what is faced. My understanding is that for those landowners who had already gone through the eminent domain process for ACP, and I think, you know, there were many that hadn't yet, but there were some that had. With MVP, I think most of them, you know, because it was so far along, most of the landowners had been taken through eminent domain. They will now, you know, if that project now doesn't go forward, it's not like the company will just, you know, it's not like it's over, right? They're going to have to go through further legal action to get their land back from the pipeline company. And when you think about the fact that none of that had to happen, if the Army Corps had just done what it was supposed to do under the National Environmental Protection Act, you know, it's just a huge injustice that has been carried out upon these landowners, you know, and just years of their lives have been taken away fighting these things, and it's still not over.
So a few hours after I recorded this interview, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Montana judge's ruling would stand to keep the Keystone XL pipeline from moving forward for the time being, but it lifted the judge's hold on water body crossings for other pipelines. I asked Lauren specifically about what this means for the Mountain Valley Pipeline. In an email message on July 9th, Lauren Stockman wrote to me that, quote, "The decision to revalidate Army Corps' deeply flawed Nationwide Permit 12 for pipelines other than KXL means that one major obstacle has been removed for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, but it still has other permits that were vacated and need redoing. These are generally expected to happen, but there is always a chance that they can be blocked. Pipeline fighters have vowed to double down on MVP, and the ACP win has emboldened them." That was Lauren Stockman, senior research analyst with the D.C.-based Oil Change International. For more information, you can visit their website at priceofoil.org. You've been listening to The Forest and the Trees, Global and Local Perspectives on the Environment, with your host, Melinda Tuhus. Tune in on the second Saturday of each month at 9:30 a.m. here on WPKN 89.5 FM for more environmental news you can use.